Finlater was already pointing out the second raft to Grayson, and Masterson nodded in satisfaction. The only disappointing aspect of the attack was that, just as their spy reports had indicated, the Dalton Yards had completed 4 new schooners, which were waiting only for their crews before putting to sea. They'd hoped to surprise those schooners and add them to Admiral Shane's squadron, but shifting, fluky winds had delayed the attack until well after dawn, and a lot of the smoke billowing above the harbor came from the schooners in question, set ablaze to prevent their capture. From the looks of things, the landing parties would be able to add the yards themselves to the bonfire shortly, along with the half-built hulls of 2 more schooners and a brig, the piles of timbers, the waiting sails, paint, turpentine, and pitch, and all the other components that went into building a ship. The seamen and Simon Masterson grieved for the ships which would never sail, never have the opportunity to pit their strength and speed against the sea and its power. The naval captain in him rejoiced at those towers of smoke and showers of sparks, and that, after all, was what mattered.
"Next time I'll have to remember to bring the marshmallows," he thought, as the nearer fire raft rolled up on its shattered side in a cloud of mingled smoke and steam. "But for right now, I'll settle for sinking that bitch right where she is."
Chapter 6. Guarnac, Mountain Cross Province, Republic of Siddermark. Bishop Militant Barnaby Worsham was not in a pleasant mood as he gazed out his window at the Guarnac canal front. There were several reasons for that, including how little water there was in that canal. Then there were the beached and burned-out barges and warehouses serving as the reminders of the Carizian raid which had left such ruin in its wake. Too many of the supplies which had been salvaged or shipped in since were under canvas rather than the weather-tight roofs which would soon be needed, thanks to that arson, despite all his work crews had been able to accomplish. Depressing as that was, what he couldn't see from his office was even more depressing. The road net which now constituted his army's only line of supply was already feeling the effect of sleet and snow, especially in the higher elevations. His quartermasters couldn't keep the dragons on their feet much longer in the increasingly inclement weather, and the Harchongians were being their usual Harchongese selves, charging exorbitant prices for the snow lizards, which were going to be a far less efficient substitute for the dragons. The Temple Lands had sent more than 2,000 of them forward, but less than 600 had yet arrived. Worse, the Temple Lands couldn't send many more without seriously crippling their own transport system over the winter months. The fact that the heretics had driven the faithful completely out of Midhold and out of all of Mountain Cross east of the Moonthorns and Calgarans, inflicting heavy casualties in the process, made him no happier. There was at least one brighter side to that particular situation, however. The Mountain Cross Rangers had suffered badly in the process, and, try as he might, Worsham couldn't convince himself that was a bad thing. Aside from their knowledge of local terrain, they had virtually no military value, and, frankly, he didn't want them corroding the discipline of the faithful militia he'd incorporated into the Army of the Silmon. Those militia had been transformed into soldiers worthy of the name, and he refused to see all that good work undone by brigands, rapists, and thieves. The influx of thousands of additional hungry civilians, the best current estimate put it at in excess of 200,000 of them, with more to come, was something else entirely. He was moving them farther west in one enormous convoy after another, as rapidly as he could, but until they got at least as far as Tarika, he had to feed them somehow, and this was a bad time to be dipping into the supply magazine he'd managed to build up here at Guarnac. The only good news on that front was that Archbishop Arthen had managed to plant more cropland than anyone had anticipated, and the mild weather, up until the last few 5 days anyway, had given the crops time to ripen. Labor to harvest them had been in critically short supply, but Worsham had diverted as many of his rear-area personnel to help as he could. Several of his pike regiments had paused on their way west to assist as well, But even that would have been too few hands if not for Inquisitor General Wilbur and Father Jerome. Worsham knew he should feel no qualms over conscripting the labor of heretics and suspected heretics, and he couldn't pretend he wasn't vastly relieved that labor had been available. But neither could he pretend that when food came up short this winter, as it inevitably must, the miserable inhabitants of Wilbur Edward's concentration camps, including the very ones who'd labored to make the harvest possible, would starve first. There was probably enough abandoned housing in Tarika for the refugees, and that was good news too. Yet while they might have roofs over their heads, they'd still need fuel, and there was precious little of that, since the sources which should have delivered the winter's supply of coal during the warmer months had been unavailable. Tarika's coal traditionally came from Glacier Heart and the Ice Ash Mountains via the new Northland Canal and the Guarnac Ice Ash Canal, both of which had suffered significant damage from the Sword of Schuller during the Rising. When they'd been put back into operation, they'd been needed to supply Worsham's own advance, and then the heretics had smashed the entire Guarnac Ice Ash and the critical western locks of the new Northland. Not only had no fuel been shipped from the east before they were put out of action, but even the Holy Langhorne Canal, the only remaining route to Tarika, could send it no farther east than East Wing Lake, nor had they been able to ship it via Sing Woo's Passage and the Hildermoss River. Even if the accursed Carisian Navy hadn't been patrolling the passage, sudden death on any shipping on the broad waterway which had always been Mother Church's own— the heretic garrison at Salik had sealed the mouth of the Hildermoss like a spiked cork. Besides, the temple lands, from which the fuel must now come, had always been a net importer of coal, and the ever-increasing demand of the foundries and manufactories supporting the jihad only made that worse. There were rich coal fields in North Harchong, but with so few canals and navigable rivers, shipping it anywhere had always been prohibitively costly, so there'd been little incentive to mine it. Harchong-y's production had increased over the last 2 years, despite the expense, but the loss of Glacier Heart and Mountain Cross coal had been a near catastrophic blow to Mother Church's coking ovens. Indeed, one reason for Connor Catesworth's advance into Glacier Heart had been to secure control of the Glacier Heart mines.
And that didn't work out either, did it? Worsham reflected sardonically. By now, all those mines must be back into full operation. And I'm sure they've spent the last few months shipping coal east to Stonar and his friends instead.
And then there were those exhortations from the Grand Inquisitor. Elaine McGuire's dispatches showed a grasp of the military realities. Jaspar Clinton didn't seem to care very much about them. He was incensed by the manner in which the faithful had been driven from their homes by the blood-stained bayonets of heretics, blasphemers, and murderers. Not content with hurling anathemas at the aforesaid heretics, he wanted to hurl the army of the Silmon at them as well, although precisely how he expected that to happen was a bit less clear. It wasn't as if Worsham didn't want a counterattack. Indeed, he'd been contemplating just that long before Clinton started fulminating. It had been so tempting to leave a portion of his own force to confront the heretics south of Wyvern Lake and pull the rest of it around to the northeast, through the Olarn Gap and Northland Province, to hit Green Valley head-on. Granted, with the pikemen's departure, his numerical advantage was less than it had been, but his actual combat power had increased, and he still outnumbered the heretics substantially. The loss ratio would undoubtedly have favored Green Valley, but he ought to have been able to make his superiority in numbers effective outside the straitjacket of the Silmon Gap. If the Carisian general had been so considerate as to move far enough west, it was even possible Worsham might have gotten his far more numerous cavalry into Green Valley's rear and done to the heretic supply lines what those accursed armored ships had done to his own. But desperately as he'd wanted to do that, Green Valley had amply demonstrated that he was no fool. It was unlikely he would allow his army to be so badly outmaneuvered as to be encircled or destroyed. At best, he might have been forced back south of Greyback Lake, which would have accomplished exactly nothing for the army of the Silmon. And to manage even that would have required Worsham to draw heavily upon the supplies he'd accumulated so laboriously at Gwarnac. He dared not do anything of the sort when Green Valley's displacement of the faithful had already inflicted such a dangerous strain on those same supplies. He could all too easily have found his army literally starving to death, and he strongly suspected that was precisely what Green Valley had hoped he'd do. So far, Clinton had restricted himself to dictating blistering homilies to the Army of God's chaplains, launching salvo after salvo of anathemas at the heretics, cursing them root and branch unto the 100th generation, and strongly urging Worsham to be as aggressive and proactive as possible. The bishop militant was more grateful for Ernest Abernethy, and the way he'd been corrupted by exposure to the realities the Army of God faced with every passing day. The auxiliary bishop couldn't argue openly with the Grand Inquisitor's views or ignore Clinton's correspondence, but he could, and did, craft his own reports and correspondence very carefully. And it wasn't as if there wasn't any good news, Worsham reminded himself. Robert Ducairne's most recent estimate was that his repair crews ought to have completed repairs to the locks between Cat Lizard Lake and Five Forks, where the new Northland Canal joined the Hildermoss River, by mid-April, and the campaigning season in northern East Haven never started before May. That was better than Worsham had dared hope. And that accomplishment, too, would owe a great deal to the slave labor from Edward's concentration camps. Worsham wondered, in his darker moments, if Father Jerome's efficiency would extend to slaking the canal's mortar with the ground skeletons of the camp inmates who would undoubtedly die laboring on them in the sub-zero temperatures of a Sidermarkian winter. In his even darker moments, he knew how relieved he was that those inmates were there to do the dying if it would reopen the canals he needed so desperately. In addition to the more optimistic estimates about the repairs, Ducairne and Maguire were promising him new and improved artillery by spring. Even allowing for the state of his supply line, Maguire believed they might actually get the first few rifled field pieces to him by the end of November. And apparently one of his foundry masters had come up with at least a partial answer to the heretics' portable angle guns. In the meantime, he'd received an entire artillery regiment, 4 6-gun batteries of full-sized angle guns of his own. The concept had been copied from the Royal Dalaran armies, but they were longer-barreled, and unlike the Dalaran's 12-pounders, the Army of God's had been designed to fire the Navy of God's standard 25-pounder shells. They'd have far less range than the heretics' angle guns, but that still represented a vast improvement on anything the Army of the Silmon had previously possessed. More had been promised, and according to his latest messages from Maguire, the reliability of the artillery's fuses had also been improved. But most enheartening of all was the new breech-loading rifle, the St. Kilmon rifle, they were going to call it. They'd actually sent a half dozen to Gwarnac, accompanied by the caution that they were still experimental models, and he'd experienced the first true optimism he'd felt since the canal raid as he examined one of them and personally fired it. The name was apt, he thought, both because the rifles had been manufactured at St. Kilmon's foundry, and because St. Kilmon was one of the most revered of Mother Church's warrior saints. He'd suffered martyrdom in the war against the fallen, fighting under the command of the Archangel Chihiro himself, and no name could have been more fitting for such a magnificent weapon. Worsham had achieved an aimed rate of fire of 6 rounds per minute with the unfamiliar rifle, 50% higher than a trained, experienced rifleman could manage with a muzzle loader. He was confident that someone properly trained with a St. Kilmon would be able to do even better. And if the hope in Maguire's private, wyvern-delivered letter turned out to be accurate, if he and Ducairne were able to convince Clinton to allow duplication of the heretic's priming caps, his infantry would finally have a weapon which could meet the accursed Carisian infantry on their own ground. The bishop militant's nostrils flared as he considered that possibility. Then he shook himself and turned away from the window. Hopeful as all that sounded, he was unlikely to receive the new rifles in useful numbers before February or even March. The Army of the Silmon would have to survive the winter without them, and that promised to be an unpleasant experience. But he'd experienced unpleasant things before. With a little luck, he'd live long enough to experience them again. And in the meantime, he had all of those reports and plans and conferences to work his way through if he intended to hold his army together long enough to kick the heretic's arse. As motivators went, he thought, his eyes hardening, that one would take some beating.
Chapter 7. City of Cherethe, Kingdom of Chisholm, Empire of Chorus.
My God, it's brisk out there!
Tavis Sonford shivered dramatically and made a beeline towards the iron stove, the cavernous fireplace which had once heated, more or less, the large, luxuriously furnished office, had been closed with brickwork through which the Delthac works stove had been ducted to the old flue, and a great improvement it was, too. Now he parked himself directly by the stove, holding his hands out over it, and Binford Raymond chuckled.
You only think it's brisk out there, Master Sonford.
The slightly built, silver-haired banker shook his head.
Spoiled by the climate in Telesburg, that's what you old Carisians are.
It's brisk enough to do for me, Sonford replied tartly. He was 20 years younger than Raymond, with brown hair and brown eyes, which always looked a bit owlish behind their wire-rimmed spectacles. Of course, owls were predators, and they were quite sharp, those eyes. Raymond only smiled, although it was still at least 10 degrees above freezing, which, he supposed, probably was on the frigid side for someone who'd been born and raised in Telesburg. He remembered his own single trip to the Carisian capital, with its brilliant flowers, exotic birds, and overpowering sunlight, and wondered how well Sonford would survive a Chisholmian winter. Or if he was going to, for that matter.
Have a seat, he invited. If you want, you can pull that armchair over by the stove.
Don't think I won't, Sonford said with a twinkle.
The old Carisian wasn't the most tactful individual Raymond had ever met, which might be something of a handicap in his mission to Chisholm, but he had a sense of humor, he was smart, and he knew the new manufacturing processes inside and out.
That was a nice touch with Her Majesty, the Chisholmian said now, sitting behind his desk as Sonford did indeed pull one of the armchairs to within a couple of feet of the stove.
I wish I could claim credit for it, but she and His Majesty started the practice in Old Chorus 2 years ago. It does rather make the point that the Crown's behind our efforts, though, doesn't it?
It certainly does, Raymond agreed, although the truth was that he was a bit in two minds about it.
Having Empress Charlien herself turn the first spadeful of dirt for the new manufactory with a silver-plated shovel had definitely underscored the Crown's commitment. The fact that the Chisholmian Treasury was a 10% partner in the endeavor should have made that clear enough for anyone, but not everyone had realized that, despite his best efforts to make it public knowledge. Besides, the visual impact of Charlien stamping on the shovel to drive its blade into the earth of Chisholm was far more immediate. It had also drawn quite a crowd, which was the reason Raymond's feelings were ambiguous. Her appearance had communicated Charlien's support for the industrialization of Chisholm to the common folk in a way the esoteric details of investments and capitalization never could. And, as always, she'd been greeted by wildly enthusiastic cheers. Unfortunately, not everyone in the crowd had been equally enthused. In fact, the guilds were beginning to recognize the implications of Carisian-style manufactories in Chisholm. They weren't entirely in favor of the notion, to say the very least, and those same enthusiastic crowds could all too easily provide cover for some lunatic with a pistol. It wasn't as if that very thing hadn't happened to Charlien before.
How long do you think it'll take? The construction phase, I mean? Sonford asked. Like you say, I'm a Carisian,
beg pardon, an old Carisian, and I don't have a very good feel for how winter weather's likely to slow things down here in Chisholm. The foundations will be in by the end of the month, unless we get really bad weather between now and then. Raymond turned a silver letter opener in his hands while he considered the question. Once they are, we'll run up the framing timbers and roof it over, then hang canvas for windbreaks. After that, we should be able to go right on working, whatever the weather does. My best guess is that the building itself will be structurally complete by the middle or end of March. After that, it's a matter of installing the machinery, and that depends on your master houseman. And how well the war's going, Sanford pointed out a bit sourly. Still, that's better than I expected. And unless something does come along that completely reorders Master Houseman's priorities, which I'm afraid has happened more than once, we should make delivery no later than April 15th. Then I imagine we'll be in operation by the end of July, unless we have trouble with the workforce, of course. How likely is that? Sanford cocked his head, those owl's eyes sharper than ever, and Raymond shrugged. To be honest, I don't know. There's a lot of enthusiasm among the people who are investing in the manufactories and among the unskilled workers. The workers especially have heard stories, wildly exaggerated, some of them, about how well-paid Carisian manufactory workers are and how the owners take people without trades and train them to do what's needed. I imagine there'll be some disappointment when they find out the workshop floors aren't really paved in gold, but we're still talking about an opportunity to triple or quadruple their earnings, and some of them will do even better than that. I'm sure you've seen how some of the aristocracy feels about the whole idea, though, and the guilds are going to be less and less happy as the damage to their prestige and economic power sinks in. I don't expect to see a lot of open public opposition, but I am afraid we'll see some acts of sabotage and vandalism. Sanford nodded, his expression thoughtful. Binford Raymond was one of the wealthiest bankers in Chisholm and a close associate of the House of Tate. In fact, he'd enjoyed a warm, personal friendship with Charlene's maternal uncle, Bertram Weston, the Duke of Halbrook Hollow, for over 35 years. Halbrook Hollow's treason had hit Raymond hard, but he was scarcely alone in that, and his own loyalty to Charlene and Caleb had never wavered. That wasn't to say the banker was a wildly enthusiastic reformist, because he wasn't. Like Halbrook Hollow, he'd been horrified by the thought of mortal rulers defying the majesty of the Church of God awaiting. At the same time, he'd been well aware of how corrupt the men governing Mother Church had become, and that had been enough, coupled with his loyalty to the House of Tate, to pull him into resolute, if not eager, support of the war against the Group of Four. He'd poured quite a bit of his personal fortune into that support. Assuming the Empire of Karis won, those investments would make him a fabulously wealthy man. Perhaps not on the level of an Edward Houseman, but staggeringly so by anyone else's standards. Of course, if the Empire of Karis lost, he wouldn't have to worry about returns on investments, because he was one of the people who would most certainly be dead. I wish I understood how anybody could pass up the chance to get in on something like this, Sanford said after a moment. I know it's happening, and I can see where Temple loyalists would resist anything that could help us win the war, but that's not what's driving most of them, or not as nearly as I can tell, anyway. The reason you can't understand is that you're a Carisian. An old Carisian. Raymond smiled as he repeated Sanford's earlier emphasis, then snorted and tossed the letter opener onto his blotter. You people are all shopkeepers, remember? You worship the almighty mark, not what really matters. All those smoky, messy, smelly manufactories of yours, disrupting the social order the archangels themselves clearly ordained when they were wise enough to make their forefathers noblemen, and filling the purses of men of no blood, no lineage, offering commoners a chance to dominate the economy? What can their majesties possibly be thinking? He shook his head with a grimace. Of course, no proper noble wants to sully his lily-white hands with anything reeking of trade and manufacturing. I know that's what they think, Binford. I just don't understand how they can think it,
especially at a time like this.
Tarvis,
some of them still resent the hell out of the way King Salus kicked their sorry asses. Anything that strengthens the crown's reach and power, and God knows building a manufacturing sector like the one in Old Corus can't do anything but strengthen the crown, is anathema to them, because they still dream of the day when the House of Lords reclaims its rightful place as the dominant power in Chisholm. Mind you, I think it's more likely the Archangels will return in glory tomorrow, but some of them are still invested in doing just that. Then they're the ones who are genuinely disdainful of this whole newfangled notion, nothing more than a fad, probably, of manufactories. Their family fortunes are founded on the ownership of land, on wheat fields and vineyards and sheep and cattle. That's what they understand, and they don't want anything to change an arrangement that suits them so well. And finally, it's new. It's not traditional, not familiar, and the writ itself warns against the dangers of too much innovation. His expression tightened with the last sentence, and Sanford looked at him thoughtfully. "You're not entirely comfortable with all of this, are you?" he asked softly, and Raymond stiffened. It was the first time the old Carisian had asked him that question, and he started to answer quickly, then paused and made himself give it the consideration it deserved. "No," he acknowledged finally. "Not entirely. But I'm even less comfortable with a lot of other things that are happening right now. I wish we didn't have to change. That the world could continue the way God and the Archangels intended, without all this dangerous tinkering with God's plan. But the world's already stopped being what I'd like it to be. And the more I hear about what the Inquisition's doing in Siddermark, the more I read Jaspar Clinton's denunciations, and the more I listen to men like Michael Steiner and Archbishop Ulis, the more I realize I have to choose a side. I have to choose whether I want to or not. I don't agree with Archbishop Michael in all ways, but he's right about that. And I can't choose to leave Mother Church in the grasp of someone like Clinton." He shook his head slowly, eyes looking beyond Sanford to something only he could see, and his voice was low-pitched and sad. "I can't begin to tell you how much I hate realizing that when this struggle is over, it's going to be impossible for the Church of Corus to ever return to its obedience to the Grand Vicar and the Temple, Tarvis. I know some of the reformers still believe, or hope, at least, that the unity of Mother Church can be restored once Zion's been purged of corruption. It's not going to happen, though. It can't. There's been too much bloodshed, especially in Siddermark, and too many people will never forgive Mother Church for allowing that to happen. And much though it grieves me, I don't think they ought to. So, here I am, a man who always wanted to be a loyal son of Mother Church, a man who spent 70 years of his life trying to be just that, dedicating the rest of my life to making the schism permanent." "Why?" Sanford asked gently. "I could say it's because I'm loyal to my queen. I could say it's because I'm appalled by Clinton's atrocities, by the realization that he sees no distinction between his will and God's. I could say it's because that even as much as this tide of innovation and change distresses me, I see how much better they'll make life for so many Chisholmians. I could say all of those things, and they'd all be true. But the biggest reason I've betrayed Mother Church, it's the only way to save her. She can't, she won't, reform herself. So someone has to make her. The reformists are right about that. And who else can possibly do that?" Silence fell, hovering between them for several minutes, until Raymond inhaled sharply. "Listen to me nattering like an old woman. I believe you had something else you wanted to discuss." Sanford looked back at him, thinking about all the other somethings he wanted to discuss, like how they were going to encourage manufactories in central and western Chisholm, away from the canals serving Lake Megan and Lake Morgan.
The coal in Eastshire, the iron deposits in the Sharon Mountains, the fact that small barges could use the Paul River to haul that iron ore downriver to the lakes, all of those made Eastern Chisholm a natural initial foothold. That was, after all, one of the reasons Edward Houseman had established his Michaelburg works on Lake Morgan. Another, of course, was that it just happened to put the Imperial Carizian Army's primary arsenal and heavy weapons facility right outside the ICA's front door, handy for deliveries and easy to protect. The Michaelburg Works had delivered its first locally produced Mondrains and rifled field artillery just last 5 day, and there were ample arguments in favor of concentrating as much as possible of Chisholm's industry around that well-guarded center and the transportation advantages of the Twin Lakes and the Edmund and King Salis canals. But the Crown remained determined to foster the same sorts of development throughout as much of the kingdom as possible, and Tavis Sanford and Binford Raymond were supposed to be figuring out how to make that happen. But somehow, at the moment... "I'm sure we both have a lot we need to discuss," he said. "But for just now, I'm a poor half-frozen Carizian lad, lost and forlorn in this barren northern wasteland. I need a guide to a hot meal, a good bottle of whiskey, and an evening of quiet conversation about something that has nothing at all to do with wars and manufactories." Those owl's eyes gazed very levelly at the banker sitting behind the desk, and the lips under them smiled. "You wouldn't know where I might find such a fellow, would you?" Chapter 8. Holy Langhorne Canal, Earldom of Usher, the Border States. Rain dripped endlessly from the branches of native Safeholdian waffle bark and near oak and imported Terran chestnut, ash and yew, as the winter evening limped toward night. It was cold, that rain, even colder than the patient, biting wind, and the well-rugged horse sighed deeply, grateful for his heavy blanket. Grain crunched in his feed bag, and tendrils of wood smoke rose white as the horse's steaming breath from the small, carefully hidden campfire. That fire burned in a stone-faced fire pit in a well-sheltered hollow 300 yards north of the Holy Langhorne Canal. Had trackers or woodsmen examined the fire pit, measured the depth of its ash, explored the carefully hidden campsite, they would quickly conclude it had been there for more than a 5 day at the very least. That, after all, was the conclusion they were supposed to reach, and the remotes of an AI named Owl had gone to considerable effort to be sure they would. In fact, it was less than 2 days old, and the single individual sitting between it and the water, perched in the shooter's blind on the lip of the canal cut, had arrived barely 3 hours ago. His hair was brown, but his eyes, those were dark as sapphire and harder than any stone, and his breath made no plume. This particular iteration of him didn't have a name. It had never needed one, since it had never existed prior to today, and he'd used at least some of his waiting time considering what he might call himself. Something that spoke to the darkness of the purpose that brought him here, he thought. Something the Inquisition would find easy to remember, whether it understood or not. He'd gone to some pains to equip this particular persona properly and set the stage for its work this night. It was entirely possible he'd need it again, and he couldn't afford to leave any questions about who'd been responsible. Not after Sarkin. "I suppose we're lucky they didn't just burn the place down and plow the ruins with salt while they were at it," he thought harshly. "They probably would have, they hadn't wanted to leave enough witnesses to get the message out." Those sapphire eyes went even harder, the face in which they lived still colder and bleaker. By Owl and Narman's best estimate, the population of Sarkin was now 30% of what it had been. 36 of the town's citizens, 23 men and 13 women, had suffered the full rigor of the punishment of Schuller after the denunciations began. And they had begun. when the impartial investigators had already decided witnesses were going to come forward and were going to name names, and when the interrogators had been ordered by the Inspector General to use whatever means were necessary to produce those witnesses, names would indeed be named. At least three of the executed men had deliberately implicated themselves, even knowing what awaited them, in order to spare others, and one of the women the Inquisition had murdered had been a harmless 40-year-old with the intellect of a 10-year-old. But the Inquisitors had, by God, found the hidden heretics, the betrayers of Holy Langhorne and Mother Church, who'd somehow detonated 400 tons of gunpowder in the middle of their own town. Of course, none of the executed culprits had personally set off the explosion. Not even the Inquisition could explain how they might have managed that and still been around for execution. But they'd known about the plot, and they'd conspired afterward to conceal what had actually happened. That made their guilt just as great as that of whoever had set the actual fuse, and so they'd paid the penalty for their crimes. And purely as a precaution, to prevent any repetition of Malik Potter's and Major Wylett Tompkins' heinous crimes, over 900 of the town's citizens, a quarter of them children, had been taken into preventative custody and transported to Camp Firmon, the Inquisition's concentration camp in Westmarch province. Some of them might even survive the winter. I guess just butchering Sittermarkians gets boring. Plenty of those to go around. They've got whole concentration camps full of them. How much challenge is there in catching more of them? Better to try some different quarry, see how Sardanin screams compared to Sittermarkian ones. I imagine a fellow gets bored just listening to the same old sounds day after day. His mouth twisted, and he closed his eyes for a moment. I'm probably being unfair. They didn't do it just for the personal satisfaction. Oh, it did satisfy them. Proved how virtuous they were, punishing the guilty. But that wasn't the only reason they did it. They wanted to make sure anybody who might be tempted to really try something like blowing up one of their powder barges would damned well know better. I wouldn't be surprised if Clinton had been primed for months, waiting for an opportunity just like this. He might have preferred for it to happen in the Republic, but maybe not. Maybe having it happen outside Sittermark worked out better for him. It sure as hell reinforces his claim that heretics are everywhere, just waiting to betray the church, if not for the ever-vigilant Inquisition. And the example's not going to be lost on anyone who might even think about actually trying to sabotage the jihad. He closed his eyes, wishing he could close the eyes of his memory as easily. But he'd watched the imagery. Not all of it. In fact, he'd been able to handle only a very small amount of it. But enough. Enough to know he'd never forget it. And enough to take measures. Haskell Seagare's pen scratched busily across the page. It was chilly in his cubbyhole cabin, despite the tightly closed windows and small coal-fired stove, but Father Haskell was a man of austerity. His fingers were cold, but he ignored the discomfort, warmed by the satisfaction of knowing he'd accomplished a distasteful task without flinching, as his duty had required. He would have preferred to return to the Inquisitor General's headquarters in Tarika, but he'd been ordered to Zion by the fastest route. That was why his barge flew the Golden Scepter banner, which gave it priority over all other traffic. When darkness fell, the red lanterns already blazing at bow and stern would assure the same precedence, although the mere fact that they were moving after nightfall should make that superfluous. Normal traffic was already mooring for the night, as the canal service regulations required, leaving only Vicar Robert's specials on the water, and they hadn't seen another barge in hours. Seagare's hated this diversion from his responsibilities in Sittermark. He wasn't so consumed by pride as to believe his was the only nose capable of sniffing out heresy, yet the proof was there to see. Hoskill C. Gayers had uncovered more hidden heretics in the Republic than any two of Wilbur Edwards' other personal aides, and now there was the horror of Sarkin. However badly he might be needed in the field, someone had to report personally to the Grand Inquisitor about the blasphemous treason they'd uncovered, and who better than the Inquisitor who'd ferreted it out to begin with? Especially if that weak-spined old woman Jacobs truly had protested to Vicar Jaspar. It was important to place the evidence proving Seagair's suspicions, and Bishop Wilbur's, of course, had, sadly, been well-founded before the Grand Inquisitor. Who would have believed such an extensive network of heretics could have concealed itself so tracelessly? Yet there they'd been, hidden until the question stripped away their mask. Surely their mere existence only re-emphasized how wise the Office of Inquisition had been to organize the Sword of Schuller before the cancer and sitter mark could spread still further into the healthy tissue of the mainland. He regretted the necessity of such stern measures, yet the need to win through to the truth had been too great to allow false mercy to stay his hand, and it would have been no kindness to the heretics themselves. Perhaps at least a few had repented at the very end, shown the eternal torment waiting for them by the foretaste of the punishment's rigor. It was never too late to return to the faith and find the cleansing mercy of God. And if they hadn't repented, by now they'd learned that anything they'd suffered at Mother Church's loving hands had been but a shadow of the eternal price awaiting those who freely gave themselves into Sean Way's service. Someone knocked on his cabin door, although calling this undersized closet a cabin seemed a gross exaggeration. The knock came again, quietly, and he laid his pen in the inkstand and sat back. "Enter." The door opened to admit another Schullerite upper priest of about Seagair's age. Unlike Seagair's, the newcomer had a full head of dark hair and a close-cropped beard, and Seagair's knew him well. They'd been at seminary together and trained as inquisitors under Archbishop Willem's own tutelage. Of course, he'd been only Father Willem at the time, but they'd known even then that he was destined to do great things in God's service. So he had, and he'd remembered his students when the time came.
"What can I do for you, Victor?" Seagairs asked, waving the newcomer into the only other chair.
"I have that report you asked for," Father Victor Tarleson said, leaned forward, and laid a folder on Seagair's desk. "I can't say there are any surprises."
"I didn't really expect any," Seagair shrugged.
"On the other hand, given that our friend Father Maxwell appeared less than eager to cooperate with us, it seemed like a good idea to double-check what he told me in St. Verdin against the supervisor's estimates."
"Do you really think he'd have dared lie to the Inquisition?"
"I don't know." Seagairs ran a hand over his shaved scalp, eyes dark. "Sean Way hides in so many places, sometimes even in the hearts of men who have no idea she's taken them for her own. Archbishop Lorink, for example." He lowered his hand and shook his head. "There's a man on the very lip of hell, willing to give the Holy Inquisition itself orders that would have stayed our hand, left all those heretics and demon worshippers in Sarkin undiscovered. But was it because he sympathized with them, or simply because of squeamishness, a desire to turn aside from the severity the archangels demand in times like these? Did Sean Way seduce him into active evil, or did she simply present herself in the guise of gentleness and mercy?"
"Schuller knows we've both seen enough of that," Tarleson agreed.
"Like Father Merton. You know him, don't you? Merton Burke. Fair-haired fellow, a little younger than you or me."
"That's him. He was with me when Vicar Jaspar sent me down to Gorath after those heretics Earl Thirsk tried to withhold. I'd always thought he had the true iron in him, but he kept urging me to go easy on them on the way back to Zion, kept whining about how sickly they were, how many of her own Sean Way was claiming along the journey. He said it was because he wanted them to reach Zion alive to be properly sifted, but I've never really been sure."
"It's hard sometimes," Seagair sighed.
Hard for people who don't have enough of Shula's iron in their souls, like Jacobs and Burke, I mean. And maybe for Father Maxwell, too. That was why I wanted you to check. The work crew supervisor says basically the same thing he did, Tarlson replied. Despite everything Potter and the others did, the explosion really only destroyed the eastbound locks. In fact, three of the lock chambers are still intact, even in the eastbound flight, and the westbound locks are already back in service. The explosion knocked out some of the pumps and fractured a couple of the main pipes, but the work crews could get to the damage fairly easily. The transfer lock's still working, too, so they can shunt barges from one lane to the other. Traffic will be slowed, but they can take both directions' barges through the westbound side until the other one's fixed.
And the supervisor's estimate on that?
Agrees with Father Maxwell's. Tarson shrugged. The Sarkin locks aren't on Vicar Robert's list for prefabricated repair sections because they're so far behind the front there seemed no way the heretics could get to them. The supervisors managed to short-stop timbers and other materials that were being sent forward to the Lake City stockpiles, though. It won't be pretty, but he says he's fairly confident they can have the replacement chambers framed in before the freeze. Whether or not he'll be able to carry out all the other necessary repairs before spring is more than he'll say at this point.
A lot better than it could have been, Seagares observed. And if that snake nest had been left intact to try again...
His voice trailed off, and they looked at one another in grim satisfaction. Silence lingered for several seconds, then Seagares gave himself a shake.
Well, now that we've got that out of the...
He broke off and froze, head cocked, listening hard.
What the shunway was that?
The drover in the howdah never heard the shot that killed him. The 500-grain bullet struck him a half-inch above and in front of his right ear at 1,600 feet per second, well above the speed of sound, and his head disintegrated as kinetic energy threw his corpse from his seat. It sprawled over the edge of the howdah, out from under the rain shelter, and blood steamed in the drizzle. The dragon didn't like the explosive crack of the rifle, but it was well trained. It stopped instantly when its drover released the guide rein, and the Pika, who decided he would call this version of himself Dialid Mab, was glad. The dragon had never hurt anyone after all. The dead drover's assistant popped his head out of the barge deckhouse. From his expression, clearly visible to Mab's enhanced vision, despite the gathering darkness and drizzle, he hadn't heard, or recognized at least, the sound of the shot. He was trying to figure out why the dragon had stopped, not what had happened to the drover to cause him to stop, and his observations on what was about to happen to the towline as momentum carried the barge over its slack length were pungent. Mab's right hand rose from the trigger of the rifle Owl had manufactured from the Delthac Works plans. This was the first time an M96 Mondrain had ever been used in action, and he couldn't think of a more fitting time or place. His rising thumb flipped up the bolt handle and moved it smoothly to the rear. The spent case flew clear, and his hand rotated, pushing the handle forward once more, chambering a new round and cocking the rear locking bolt on the return stroke, then dropped straight back down. His index finger found the trigger. Another shot exploded, echoing along the canal cut, and the assistant drover's head disappeared back into the deckhouse in its own eruption of blood. The other passengers must have figured out what was happening when the corpse hit the deck at their feet. Half a dozen Army of God infantry swarmed onto the deck, checking the priming of their rifles as they looked for the shooters who'd fired those two shots. And Mab's thin smile was far colder than the raw, wet twilight. He worked the bolt of Tagus Malden's brainchild a second time, found a target, squeezed.
Gunfire?
Seagares stared at Tarlson, his expression startled. There wasn't any fear in that expression, but there was confusion in plenty, and Tarlson shook his head. He opened his mouth,
then snapped it back shut as a deafening volley of rifle fire exploded from the barge's deck. The cabin door flew open, and another Schulerite, one of Seagair's assistants, shoved his head through it, his eyes wild.
"Both drovers are dead,"
he blurted, and Seagair's expression hardened as he saw the huge bloodstain splattered across the other priest's cassock.
"And the helmsman, too! What's happening? Who's doing all that damn shooting?"
Seagair's demanded while gunfire continued to hammer the air.
"I don't know. Somebody's up on the west side of the embankment."
"Somebody? You mean one somebody?"
"I don't know,"
the other Schulerite repeated.
"I'm not a soldier. The sergeant was shouting something about get the bastard. It sounded like he meant one person. I started to ask him and then..."
He broke off with a shudder, and Seagair's eyes narrowed.
"The sergeant's dead too?"
he demanded, and the other priest nodded, his face white with fear. The Alid Mab pressed the release, and the empty 10-round magazine fell out of the rifle. He inserted a fresh one, chambered around, and looked for another target. It was difficult to find one. The scene before him was daylight clear to his light-gathering optics, but there was no one left alive among the bodies sprawled across the barge. 4 of the vessel's passengers, 3 inquisitors and 1 soldier, had attempted to escape by plunging over the side. Unfortunately for them, his high perch had given him a clear field of fire. 2 of the inquisitors floated lifelessly in the canal. The 3rd Schulerite and the soldier had gone to the bottom already. The remaining handful of AOG riflemen had scrambled back inside the deckhouse as soon as they realized the devastatingly accurate fire ripping through them didn't care how dark it was. He'd placed every one of his bullets within less than an inch of his point of aim, in conditions under which all they could see of him were muzzle flashes. Worse, they'd realized all that death and destruction was coming from a single marksman. There was only a single rifle, and only one of them, on top of the embankment, yet whoever was behind it had already killed a dozen of them, and done it with terrifying speed. Many of the church's soldiers had heard rumors about the new heretic pistols that could fire for hours without reloading. Most hadn't really believed the whispered accounts, and even if they had, no one had warned them rifles could do the same thing. Yet that was obviously what they faced, and so they'd gone to ground, found cover wherever they could. Return fire crackled sporadically back in Mab's direction. It was more scattered than it had been, slower even than the usual restrictions of muzzle loading might have imposed. Partly that was because they were reloading full-length rifles in the cramped confines of the barge's deckhouse, but it was also because they were firing through loopholes hastily cut through window shutters or even hacked through the planking of the hull. Anywhere they could find some protection against that impossible rifle blazing away out of the gloom. Out of the darkness, actually. Full night had arrived, and the barge's defenders fired blindly, their only hope that enough unaimed fire might actually hit whoever had slaughtered so many of their fellows. Mab located one of the loopholed shutters, settled his sights, and waited until a reloaded rifle poked back through the opening. His own rifle cracked before the muzzle loader could, and someone shrieked as his bullet punched through the flimsy cover. He smiled with cold satisfaction and went patiently searching for his next victim. He didn't really have to be here in person. He could have simply provided Owl's remotes with similar weapons and sent them to do the deed, yet he'd never seriously considered doing this any other way. A corner of his mind felt a detached sort of pity for the soldiers on that barge. Probably at least half of them were conscripts who hadn't volunteered even for the Army of God, far less to serve the Inquisition. Yet whatever had brought them into the church's service, they were part of what had happened at Sarkin. Seagairs and Tarleson and the other Inquisitors had been the brain and the malice behind that barbarism, but these soldiers had been the hands that carried it out, and at least some had lent themselves to it as willingly as any Schulerite. Besides, They were between him and his prey. He killed 5 more of them before the survivors refused to shoot back even from hidden positions. They huddled there, terrified, and he set the rifle's safety and laid it aside. He'd chosen his position because it was 40 miles from the nearest town. Even the Inquisition would find it difficult to accuse innocent townsfolk of complicity this far from their own homes, and the campsite Owl had built, like the tracks of the horse on which Mab had ridden to the ambush site, would offer additional evidence that the attack had been launched by an outsider. That might not prevent someone like Seagairs or Clinton from launching reprisals against the locals anyway, but it was the best protection he could give them. And now it was time to finish this and give them a little more protection in the process. The dead helmsman had fallen across the tiller, nosing the vessel into the bank. It waited for him, motionless, as he strode down the steep embankment, as if the rain-slick grass and mud were a broad staircase, and it was full daylight instead of night. He crossed the tow road and stepped into the spill of illumination from the running lights with a revolver in each hand, then leapt lightly to the barge's deck. Haskell Seagairs gripped his pectoral scepter in his left hand and a double-barreled pistol in his right as he heard someone land cat-lizard-footed among the body's topside. A babble of half-hysterical prayer spilled from someone behind him. It sounded like Tarlson. And he heard the harsh breathing of the 4 soldiers crouched in the darkness between the remaining Inquisitors and the barred deckhouse door. The lamps had been extinguished, plunging the interior into darkness to provide concealment for its occupants while any attacker was silhouetted against the running lights. He smelled gun oil, powder smoke, the stink of blood, and the sweat of fear, and his stomach was a singing void. His nostrils flared as he tried to beat down his own terror, but that terror refused to be subdued. He didn't want to believe the panicky soldier's insistence that all this death and carnage had been wreaked by a single rifleman, yet his own hearing told him it had. He'd heard the shots coming with incredible rapidity, yet clearly from the same weapon, and an icy fist gripped his heart as he tried to imagine how that could have been made possible. Whoever had jumped onto the barge's deck was as still and silent as the death he'd visited upon the bodies strewn across it. The stillness twisted already tormented nerves still tighter, and Seagairs heard his own voice muttering a childhood prayer for protection against evil. Dialid Mab waited while the Snark's remotes swarmed into the barge's interior and located his targets. There were only 13 left, 4 soldiers, 5 priests, and 2 Shularite lay brothers crouched in the deckhouse, while the last 2 crewmen huddled in the bottom of the hold. Fine. He knew where they were, and he raised his booted right foot. The deckhouse door flew open. Wood screamed as the locking bar's bulkhead brackets ripped free, and Haskell Seagairs had a moment to see a towering, broad-shouldered shape etched against the forward running light. It was barely a flicker in the eye of eternity, and then the shape's hands vomited fire. Seagairs realized he was screaming, although he couldn't hear the sound of his own voice through the thunder of gunfire in a confined space, and the pistol in his hand jerked up. Yet, even as it moved, he seemed trapped in quicksand, the air resisting movement like thick syrup. The pistol rose slowly, so slowly, and the deckhouse was Shanwei's own cauldron of crisscrossing thunderbolts. No one could fire as rapidly as that nightmare shape. No one. It simply wasn't possible. The first 2 soldiers were dead before the door's panels smashed back against the bulkhead. One of them discharged his rifle, but it was a dead man's shot, burying itself in the deck, The second simply tumbled sideways into one of the remaining soldiers. Jostled by his falling companion, the AOG private shoved back, trying desperately to free himself of the spasming corpse and bring his bayoneted rifle into play. The second round from the revolver in Dialid Mab's right hand hit him squarely in the throat. The fourth soldier did manage to fire his weapon. He was less than 4 feet from his target, but that shape of darkness and muzzle flash never paused. It fired again, and the last of the soldiers was down.
"Demon!"
Seagares shrieked and discharged both pistol barrels. He hit the attacker. He knew he'd hit him, but his target didn't even stagger. And then he screamed again, this time in agony, as a revolver bullet shattered his right knee. He went down, both hands clutching at the pain, and heard the drumbeat thunder of those impossible pistols go on and on and on. The last Shularite went down. Dialid Mab stood in the choking fog of gunsmoke, listening to the shrieks, and the thing that troubled him was that those sounds of anguish didn't trouble him. He holstered the revolver in his left hand, cleared the other's cylinder, and began reloading. Seagares sobbed, curled into a twisted knot, hands hot and slick with the blood pumping from his ruptured flesh. Agony was his entire world, yet even through the pulsing waves of pain, he felt a deeper, crawling horror as the man who'd turned the deckhouse into a slaughter pen calmly reloaded his monstrous weapons. It was impossible to hear anything after so much gunfire in so small a space. Yet there was enough light through the broken doorway to touch the falling cartridge cases with glitter as they fell to the deck, and his terrified eyes crawled up to the long-fingered hands, methodically placing them in the revolver's cylinder. They finished with the first pistol and holstered it, then started on the second. Mab took his time. He could have reloaded far more quickly, but he chose not to. He chose to stand there in the darkness, in the smell of smoke and blood, in the sobs of the wounded, and replenish each chamber individually, one at a time. The barge's defenders had hit him 3 times. That was better than he'd actually expected, but small arms fire was no threat to a last-generation Pika. Even if it had been, the anti-ballistic smart fabric of the shirt under his coat would have prevented any damage. He wondered if Father Haskell realized both rounds from his pistol had hit their target without any effect at all, and hoped the Shularite had. He slid the second revolver back into its holster, then stepped across Seagares, ignoring the Inquisitor's sobs of pain. He never doubted the depth of the man's anguish, but it was little enough compared to the agony he'd inflicted upon others. And it would be over soon. He bent, and bloody hands flailed frantically at his wrist as he twisted his left fist in the front of Victor Tarlson's cassock. Tarlson screamed as Mab plucked him from the floor one-handed, as easily as he might have picked up a kitten. Mostly it was born of pain, that scream, as shattered bone and cartilage shifted in his left knee, but panicky terror fluttered at its heart. Mab wondered if the upper priest had begun to realize he and Seagares had been deliberately immobilized rather than killed outright.
"Please, please," the Inquisitor whispered. "Oh, please."
"It's a little late for that, Father Victor,"
a deep, deep voice said, and Tarlson whimpered as the monster thrust him backward. His toes, he realized, were at least an inch above the deck, yet the impossibly strong arm holding him didn't even quiver.
"I wonder how many people have said the same thing to you,"
that rumbling voice continued.
I didn't. I don't.
Tarleson couldn't have explained even to himself what he was trying to say, and it didn't matter anyway.
I've been looking forward to this moment.
His captor overrode him, and his whimper became a high whine as something cold touched his throat in a dull gleam of steel.
This is a Carisian midshipman's dirk.
The level calm of the other man's voice was the most dreadful thing Tarleson had ever heard.
I brought it along for the occasion. I don't know if you remember the names, but Gwilym Monthyr and Lanser Sversmon were friends of mine.
Breath sobbed in Victor Tarleson's nostrils, and his eyes were huge, for he did recognize the first of those names.
Understand me, priest,
that executioner voice said,
because for the first time in your life, you're about to hear the truth. Your Langhorn was no archangel, just a lunatic, a liar, and a mass murderer. Your Schuler was a psychotic. Your church is nothing but an obscene lie, and you've helped torture and murder thousands in the name of a religion whatever god there truly is would spit upon.
Tarleson's brain whirled, whiplashed by terror and anguish. No. No. It was a lie. It had to be a lie. All of it.
Look at me, priest.
Despite himself, Tarleson obeyed and squealed in horror as his captor's sapphire eyes began to glow with hellish brightness.
I'm older than your church,
the abomination behind those eyes told him.
I'm older than your holy writ. I was born, lived, and died before your first ancestor opened his eyes on this world, and I will personally destroy your church. I will eradicate it from the face of the universe. Men and women will remember it only as what it truly was, a monstrous, perverted lie concocted by madmen who only thought they were gods. They'll be known for what they truly were. And so will the butchers who served them. Think about that, priest. Take that thought to hell with you. Langhorn and Schuler are waiting for you there.
Tarleson stared into those blazing blue eyes, then grunted in fresh, explosive agony as the dirk split his heart. The hilt's crossguard slammed against his breastbone, and 14 inches of steel drove straight through his body. 5 inches of that bloody blade protruded from the far side of the deckhouse wall, pinning him with his feet still off the deck, and that dreadful promise followed him into the darkness. Dialid Mab stepped back, watching the life and horrified knowledge fade from Victor Tarleson's eyes. Then he reached into his coat's inner pocket, withdrew the letter, and tucked it into the neck of Tarleson's cassock, where no one could fail to find it. No doubt the Grand Inquisitor would dismiss it, brush aside its promise, just as he'd brushed aside Caleb and Charlian's promise that Inquisitors taken on the field of battle would find no quarter from Karras. After all, Clinton was in Zion, secure from any hand of vengeance. Yet even as he dismissed it, a small, poisonous worm of doubt would gnaw its way into the secret places of his heart. And whatever he might say, or even truly think, the letter's content would leak. Other Inquisitors would hear of it, just as they'd heard of rows of heads on stakes along the Divin River. And unlike their master, they were not secure in Zion. He turned from Tarleson's corpse. He'd brought only a single dirk, but the army of God had been kind enough to provide plenty of bayonets. He bent to detach one from a dead man's rifle and heard Hoskell Seagair's high, piercing squeal of panic as he, too, saw the glowing eyes Tarlsan had taken to hell with him.
"I haven't forgotten you either, Father," he promised.
Chapter 9. Cherik Karmay Kyrode, the South March Lands, Republic of Sidermark. The rain turned what would have been a miserable night into a wretched one. It was cold, heavy, and persistent, and it showed no sign of abating any time soon. Nor did Sir Reynos Alvarez expect it to. He'd grown up in the Duchy of Thorast. In fact, the estate on which he'd been born lay at almost precisely the same latitude as his present soggy position. Unlike the army of Shiloh's Desnarian commander, he was thoroughly familiar with the seasonal weather patterns, and this pounding rain had come out of the west, which, at this time of year, strongly suggested more rain would follow close upon its heels. He stood in his tent's open fly, listening to water beat on its canvas, and tried not to think about how miserable his men must be. Each of his infantrymen had been issued a smallish tarpaulin, which could be laced together with the ones issued to the other members of his 16-man section. In theory, if all 16 were combined, they formed a tent large enough for the entire squad, and smaller numbers of men could combine their tarpaulins to provide nominally adequate cover. In fact, it was often difficult to find something to use as tent poles, and even when that problem failed to present itself, the junction points had a nasty tendency to let wind or rain slip through. There were similar arrangements for the cavalry, and each man had also been issued an oilskin poncho, although quite a few had managed to lose their ponchos early on in the campaign. Before they realized just how miserable a good drenching rain could be, others had arranged to lash them to the sides of their attached supply wagons, usually after presenting a suitable bribe to the drovers. That was a better arrangement, although it still left the minor problem that unless the poncho's owner realized it was going to rain before the army broke camp in the morning, the wagon and his poncho would be out of reach when the rain actually began falling. Alvarez knew all of that, and while he possessed in full an aristocrat's ability to quash any soft-hearted feelings he might cherish for the men in the ranks, he was a general, not a pasqualate, he also knew their present misery would make them less efficient on the march, less effective in combat, and far more susceptible to coughs, colds, and all the other ills to which flesh was heir. Yet for all their misery, his troops were far better off than the majority of the Duke of Harless's men. Not all of them, of course. His cavalry regiments and the majority of his officers had both better tentage and an abundance of orderlies, batmen, and servants to tend to their needs. Alvarez fully realized that he himself was provided with servants whose sole function was to see to his own comfort. He had very few of them, however, and there was a difference between the commander of an entire army and a captain in a cavalry regiment. There was a reason the Royal Dalaran Army had imposed draconian limits on the number of servants and camp followers its units might take into the field with them. "And we were damned smart to do it," Alvarez reflected glumly, looking out into the silvery shimmer of the rain, lit by the lanterns of his headquarters group. "If I'd ever doubted that, watching Harless trying to move his army through this slop would have cured me." Unfortunately, Alvarez's army was stuck behind Harless's, and there wasn't a damned thing he could do about it. What had looked like a march of 3 5-days when they left Thesmar was well on its way to taking twice that long, and Alvarez couldn't quite convince himself the heretics wouldn't find something unpleasant to do with the extra time. The dearth of any inhabitants in the vicinity, even faithful Sidermarkians made themselves scarce when Desnarian foragers swept through like locusts, had dried up what had been the Dalaran army's best information sources, and he felt as if the entire army of Shiloh was advancing blindly into some black, bottomless void. He'd strongly considered asking for
or even demanding, permission to pass his troops through the Desnarians, knowing that they could have reached Fort Terrace and relieved General Walker long before Harless's troops could. Unfortunately, he'd known permission would be denied, and that asking for it could only have intensified the building tension between him and the Desnarian commander. Despite that, he'd sent home private dispatches, pleading, almost begging Duke Southar and Duke Fern to grant him the discretion to operate independently. Not that he expected it to do any good, especially when Father Sullivan declined to endorse his request. Alvarez's intendant remained focused on combining with the much larger Desnarian component of the Army of Shiloh in order to provide Mother Church's mailed fist with the greatest possible weight. Weight, is it? Alvarez's lips tightened. They'll be lucky if they haven't lost a quarter of their men to sickness or desertion by the time we get to Fort Terrace. Just how much weight are they going to be able to add to an attack after that? The answer, he suspected, would be not very much. Merlin Athrawus was unable to read Alvarez's mind as he considered the imagery, but if he had been able to, he would have found himself in agreement with the Dalaran. The Army of Shiloh lay sprawled along the high road like a vast, sluggish, untidy serpent, a very wet and muddy serpent. And like any marching formation, its fastest speed was that of its slowest element, which happened to be what had originally been called the Army of Justice. By the standards of medieval armies, the Desnarians weren't doing all that badly. By the standards of which they ought to have been capable, they were a shambling disaster. The fall and winter rains of southern Siddermark were setting in with a vengeance, which, given the effect it had already exerted on the invaders, was the one good aspect of what promised to be a nasty winter. The provisions of the Book of Pasquale and the efforts of the Order of Pasquale kept Safeholdian Army's sickness rates enormously lower than for any pre-industrial army in Old Earth's history, but they were certain to rise in this sort of weather. Even better from the Allies' perspective, the miserable travel conditions slowed Harless's foraging parties, which in turn further slowed his army's rate of march. It also gave the handful of farmers who hadn't already refugeed out of the South March time to get themselves and their families out of the Army of Shiloh's path, taking as much as possible of their livestock with them and making the foragers' task that much harder. But what was killing their mobility even more effectively than the weather, he thought with profound satisfaction, was the fact that no one but the Imperial Carizian Army had ever thought about adopting a corps organization. Safeholdian armies moved in one solid mass because, until very recently, no single element of any army could fend for itself without the support of its other elements. Before the introduction of the rifled flintlock and the socket bayonet, light infantry, missile troops armed with bows, matchlocks, or arbalests, had required heavy infantry, pikemen, to hold off cavalry. The same had held true for the mounted arms. Horse archers could shower heavy cavalry with arrows or arbalest bolts from well beyond the reach of sword or lance, but missile-armed cavalry was unable to withstand the charge of heavy horse, which managed to force combat upon it, and shorter range than missile-armed infantry. And so all the elements had to be kept together. Not only that, but it was difficult to deploy quickly for combat. If a commander knew the enemy was in the vicinity, he tried to arrange the units in his marching column so that they could form for battle as rapidly as possible. But rapidly, in this case, meant somewhat faster than an arthritic snail. It had always taken the better part of a day for a traditional Safeholdian army to simply align itself to engage an opponent under good conditions. Under bad conditions, it could take far longer. Fortunately, any foe it had been likely to run into had faced the same problems.